Which word do you suppose is more important in the phrase social media? The social part or the media part? Congress wants to know is why I'm asking. Also, a chat with Bill Ackman, activist, investor, and oh so proud of it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdov, the 31st of October today, Tuesday. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Google, Twitter, and Facebook were on Capitol Hill today, the first of what will surely be a series of hearings into social media and the 2016 election. The TLDR version of questioning by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, too long, didn't read, is what that stands for, by the way. It goes like this. What did the companies know about the Russians and what they were doing, and when did they know it? On Facebook alone, we learned yesterday, a Russian group cranked out more than 80,000 posts that reached more than 126 million users. We will get to what possible solutions might be in just a minute, but first a brief detour into Facebook ads, Facebook content, and a refresher on just how social media makes money. Marketplace's Rima Kreis gets us going with that.
When I scroll through my Facebook feed, sandwiched between a status update from a high school friend, it's a girl, and a job announcement from another friend, there is an ad for a website that sells flowers, the same flowers I sent to my mom last week for her birthday.
This is called behavioral retargeted ads.
It's also called one of the many ways Facebook makes money, says Aninda Ghosh, a professor of business analytics at New York University.
Some pricing models are based on just showing you an ad. And some pricing models are based on you actually clicking and engaging with the ad.
Facebook pulled in more than $9 billion in ad revenue last quarter. But without us, it would have nothing.
We are absolutely the product.
Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina. She says Facebook analyzes its more than 1.3 billion daily users nonstop. It tracks what we post, what we like, how we interact with our friends.
It has tracking pixels all over the web, so it knows your browsing history. It's purchasing people's financial data.
Not to mention sending users a steady stream of alerts and notifications to keep them coming back to the site again and again. At last count, the average user spent 50 minutes a day on Facebook and Instagram. Ari Lightman is a professor of digital media at Carnegie Mellon University.
So the longer you're on Facebook, the more data you're providing, the more information that they're collecting.
The better off, he says, Facebook will be at delivering us into the hands of just the right advertisers. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
So with the business model as preface, what might the regulatory remedy be? How to control political ads while not stifling legitimate content, all the baby pictures and birthday wishes? Marketplace's Ryan Kyloff has that one.
Say you're Vladimir Putin and you wanted to buy a TV ad that says vote for Donald. Well, that's illegal, and we have safeguards that prevent foreigners from influencing our elections. But as the country has learned, the same safeguards haven't been extended to digital space. That's one thing a bipartisan Senate bill called the Honest Ads Act hopes to correct.
First is to extend the definition of electioneering communications to the digital domain.
Alex Howard is deputy director of the Sunlight Foundation, a government transparency watchdog. He says the bill would require tech companies like Facebook to disclose who is buying its ads and to put this info in a public database. But when that random Facebook friend shares a vote for Donald meme, one example of organic content, this bill doesn't help you find out if that meme was paid for.
That dichotomy between paid advertising and organic content, you know, is at the heart of this challenge.
Dave Levine teaches law at Elon University. He says policing organic content is harder
because now you're getting into the business model that makes Facebook a speech platform.
Levine says Facebook's fully capable of finding and filtering out questionable news content, like it does with pornography and copyrighted material. But he adds, as long as political content drives activity and ad revenue, Facebook has no market incentive to remove it. And that regulating this stuff would basically mean regulating free speech.
And this is the trade-off associated with having speech platforms in the first place.
Levine says Americans don't want to limit free speech online. And that's exactly what makes Facebook and Twitter the perfect targets. In New York, I'm Ryan Kyloth for Marketplace.
Wall Street today. October is in the books, not just on Wall Street, actually. Traders went out on a high note. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Tomorrow is, at very long last, tax day on Capitol Hill. House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Kevin Brady is going to let the rest of us see what congressional Republicans have been working on these many months. A couple of things to keep in mind about this bill. First of all, the tax cuts in it are going to be deficit financed. The House and Senate budget plans that passed last week allow for $1.5 trillion of additional debt to pay for lower taxes. Number two, even with that $1.5 trillion buffer, Brady and company are looking for ways to pay for more tax cuts. House leaders said today that the deductions people are allowed to take for state and local taxes on their federal returns are probably going to go bye-bye. Also, not likely to survive in a GOP tax bill for reasons of both principle and pay for the estate tax. Marketplace's Bree Benishore explains that one.
If you have a lot of money, more than $5.5 million for an individual, $11 million for a couple, and you want to leave it to your kids when you go, Uncle Sam is going to want a piece. And not a small piece, 40%.
It's bad enough on my children that I die, and now the government's going to tax that event.
Pete Bonds owns Bonds Ranch, which raises cattle in 9 states. Uncle Sam will take 40% of the money Bonds leaves to his heirs above that $5.5 million threshold. So the $5.5 million he can pass down, but anything more than that gets taxed at 40%.
The way it makes me feel is that upon my death, that the kids will have to buy the ranch back from the government. And that's not fair.
How you feel about the estate tax really depends on how you conceive of fairness. How fair is it, for example, to essentially tax heirs?
It's an income, sort of a lottery windfall for people, and this is a tax on that windfall.
Chuck Maher is at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says we tax lottery winnings, and heirs won the lottery by being born.
The United States is not an aristocracy, that we don't want to have generation upon generation of assets build up untaxed to get the sort of wealthy dynasties.
Adam Michel is a policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He says the estate tax is unfair for another reason.
This is money that the government has already taxed, often multiple times.
Well, some of it has, as business income and capital gains. But some of it has escaped taxation entirely, according to Maher.
Roughly half of the money in wealthy estates has never been taxed before.
It's investments that have never been cashed out and therefore never taxed. Taxing that, he says, is pretty fair. And in any case, middle-class income earners are no strangers to double taxation either.
Middle-class people pay income and payroll taxes on every paycheck, right? They get double taxed every 2 weeks.
When the estate tax was created in 1916, the idea was to make sure the wealthy were paying something on their assets, just like wage earners were. Opponents of the estate tax say these days it affects family businesses. Adam Michel at the Heritage Foundation.
The estate tax most often falls on small, medium, and even large privately owned family businesses.
Pete Bonds, the rancher, says land-rich, cash-poor businesses like ranches are ill-equipped to pay an estate tax, especially as land values rise.
There's been several ranches that have been broken up because they basically had to sell part of the ranch to pay off the government.
But the data suggests this is extremely rare. Only about 5,000 households in the U.S. paid the estate tax in 2016. Of them, only about 50 were small businesses or farms, according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. There are exemptions and special rules for farmers that mean, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, only 0.6% of farms have to pay an estate tax. For the families that do pay an estate tax, the tax rate on their entire wealth ends up being fairly low in reality, says Maher.
16, 18 cents on the dollar. There's deductions, there's the exemption, there's all kinds of loopholes.
Over the past two decades, Congress has dramatically reduced the level of the estate tax from 55% to 40% and the number of people it applies to. So very few families end up paying it these days. But it does bring in non-trivial revenue. Stephen Bank teaches business law at UCLA Law School.
There's actual money there. We'd have to replace it. The cost of repealing it's projected to be $269 billion over the next decade.
That's a lot of money, but not an enormous amount as taxes go. Despite that fact, and the fact that not that many people pay it, the estate tax has an outsized presence in the debate over tax reform. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Botox is a $2.8 billion revenue stream for the pharmaceutical giant Allergan. It's also, and not for nothing, the end-user product of a neurotoxin, Clostridium botulinum, that is so lethal that the safeguards the U.S. government demands on the production process basically give Allergan a monopoly. Cynthia Kunz has the cover story of the world's deadliest supply chain in the most recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi, thanks for coming on the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I don't mind telling you this was mildly terrifying, this article. Do me a favor and start where you started the piece. The entry into the Allergan labs and the whole protection system they set up for the chemicals behind this drug.
Sure. So when you get to Allergan's facility in Irvine, this is where they do a lot of the research into Botox and where they might make the drug. And so the work that's done in Irvine has to be done with a very high level of security and protection because, first of all, the toxin is highly lethal. And so for people working in those labs, the company has to guard against anything happening to them. Right. But then also, if this toxin were to ever get in the wrong hands, it could be used as a potential agent of bioterrorism. So the company has to be cognizant of all the protections that the government puts in place to protect the botulinum toxins.
How did we get to the point then where people inject this stuff into their faces, but also Allergan has, in essence, a government-facilitated monopoly on this drug?
This is an actually incredible medical breakthrough, and that can never be taken away from the story. That is one of the most amazing things, is that scientists were brave enough and smart enough to work with this toxin and find out what it could do in terms of controlling motor nerves and stopping some sort of spasticity disorders. That this is some of the first uses in people who basically did not have a functioning quality of life. I mean, they didn't have a quality of life. They were barely functioning because of these muscle spasms that they were dealing with. And so it was actually years ago, over a century ago, that initially a scientist said, hey, wait, this could potentially be used medicinally. That's part of the story that often gets overlooked because everyone thinks of Botox and they think of, right, of aging.
Cosmetic, sure. But the other part of this is that the government is so worried about this, the actual root toxin getting out, that it has basically made it impossible for competitors to get into the field.
Yeah, the barriers to entry are quite high. And there's a few reasons for that. First of all, it's scientifically very difficult to replicate Botox. It's protected by a trade secret. So there's no sort of playbook in that regard to directly replicate Botox. But even if you were to figure it out, you'd have to spend a substantial amount of money investing in security. I mean, you have to have a completely dedicated facility with a very high level of security that probably doesn't mirror anything else in your supply chain. For people who do want it for the cosmetic purpose, which is where the company would make more money per injection, you're really looking at coming up against a brand like Coca-Cola or Kleenex or Xerox, yeah, where the brand itself is very powerful.
You talk to some folks who figure that by 2020, this is going to be a $4 billion enterprise.
It's incredible. It's their biggest drug. It's continuing to grow. It's really showing a lot of potential. And I guess what really could happen here is that, say it's successful in something like depression, there are a lot of patients they could pick up through that. So other companies are trying to get in there and even just make other drugs that might be like Botox, but it's going to be really tough to compete with this franchise.
Cynthia Kunz covers pharmaceuticals from Bloomberg News, writing most recently on Botox and Allergan, the company that makes it. Cynthia, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up,
I mean, it's really the activists that have kind of replaced the J.P. Morgans and Carnegies of the world.
One activist investor puts himself in some pretty good company. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 28 points today, about a 10%, 23,377. The Nasdaq up 28 points, 0.4%, 6727. The S&P 500 up 2 points, almost a 10%, 25.75. As we told you, technology companies had something of a grilling on Capitol Hill today. Twitter had the hardest time markets-wise, shares down about 3%. Google parent Alphabet declined less than a 10%. Facebook actually rose about a 10%. Under Armour had a very, 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 very big hairy miss on third quarter earnings today, with the company acknowledging that sales of women's training apparel, outdoor outfits, and basketball shoes suffered, you know, so most of their line. Under Armour shares off 23.7% today. 0.7% in addition to the 23. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a corporate annual meeting next week that's getting a lot of attention in certain circles, certain decidedly Wall Street circles. Bill Ackman, who runs a hedge fund called Pershing Square Capital Management, has bought up a chunk of ADP, the payroll processing company, and he wants some seats on the board of directors and some changes in the way the company is run. That has not gone over well at ADP, as you might imagine, but it is very much in keeping with Ackman's MO. He's done versions of the same thing at Target and Herbalife, JCPenney as well, with varying results. Bill Ackman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
There are a zillion companies out there that you could have decided to invest in and take a stand on. Why ADP?
ADP is a great company. It's been around almost seven decades. And from the first six of those decades, it was really a dominant company in the space. But what's happened in the last decades is the company's become a bit lethargic, you know, inefficient. And there's a big opportunity to improve the company's profitability by reducing costs and operating more effectively and efficiently.
You have found yourself now in a spitting contest with Carlos Rodriguez, the CEO of ADP. If you win on the 7th and get these three board seats you're looking for, how do you expect that to go?
I think it will go well. I mean, you know, unfortunately, we ended up in a proxy contest here. It was not our plan or intent. And usually when proxy contests happen, it's more for emotional reasons on the part of the company than really economically rational reasons. So what we're trying to do here is help restore ADP to the greatness and position it had many years ago. And that has a very important impact on all of the employees and the customers the company serves.
You'll understand if I point out here that you're portraying yourself very much as the White Knight.
Yeah, I think we are. You know, we're not looking to take over the company. You know, the ideas we've had, you know, I would say a very, you know, kind of a groundswell of support from shareholders who are very open to the idea of this company running itself more efficiently and very concerned about the fact that ADP has lost a huge amount of market share in their so-called enterprise business. And ADP has not yet come up with a product to compete with these new entrants, and it's a grave threat to the company.
Let me change gears here for a second and ask you this question. If I call you an activist investor, is that an insult?
No, it's an honor.
Why so?
You know, if you think about what's happened to corporate America, it used to be, you know, 150 years ago, the Carnegies and the J.P. Morgans and the Vanderbilts of the world were major shareholders of companies. And when those businesses underperformed, they made changes to the management and the boards, and they kept them focused. I mean, it's really the activists that have kind of replaced the J.P. Morgans and Carnegies of the world in the sense that we're buying large stakes in companies. We have very concentrated positions, and we care enormously about this business and how it's going to perform over the long term. That's the basic idea, and I think it's an honorable mission.
Can't get Bill Ackman on the phone and not ask him about some of your less successful ventures. Herbalife is one. Valiant this year is another. I wonder if you are looking for a win after what's been a rough go for you.
Sure. So let's actually, while I've got you on Herbalife, it's an important one. Herbalife is a company causing enormous economic harm to the citizens of this country and to 95 other countries around the world. And we, as an activist in this case, sounded the alarms about the business. That led to, and we're short the stock, which means we're betting the stock will go lower.
To the tune of $1 billion. I mean, there was a documentary that you participated in called Betting on Zero with Ted Braun at USC. We did that interview, and we told that whole story.
Yes. And so my point here is, like, just go to the Herbalife story. I view Herbalife as an enormous success because we've surfaced the harm the company has caused. We catalyzed the FTC to investigate the company. The government has fined the company $200 million. And we think, well, ultimately, the company will ultimately collapse. Now, as an investor, we've lost money because we shorted the stock.
Right.
And the company has purchased about 35% of the outstanding shares, Carl Icahn another 20-odd percent of the outstanding shares. And that's done a pretty good job holding the stock price up. But that's a temporary phenomenon. But I think
you're $1 billion into this. You better believe hope that goes down.
We certainly believe. But my point here is these are good for America type investments. Now let's talk about a bad for America situation. So the Valiant investment was a case where we made the mistake of being a passive investor in the company, which is not what we normally do. And we made a bet on the management of the company to do the right thing.
And management did not do the right thing. Among other things, they massively overpaid for an acquisition. They marked up the price of a couple of drugs by very large amounts, attracting appropriate congressional scrutiny and scorn. They massively damaged the reputation of the company, and it caused the stock price to collapse, and we lost 85% of our investment in the company.
Or $4 billion for Lehman.
A huge amount of money.
Yeah.
Enormous amount of money, which I incredibly regret. What we did subsequent to that, though, is I joined the board of the company, and I led the decision to fire the CEO in the first weekend I was on the board. I helped recruit a new CEO by the name of Joe Papa, who is a honorable, ethical, capable executive. The company has 29,000 employees, and we did, I think, a very good job stabilizing the business, at which point I left the board of the company. So again, a disastrous economic investment for me, and of course, we're always looking for wins. I think, again, there we're on the right side of fixing problems. And we've had a couple of, certainly one large loss in the short term. And when we lose money, we lose big because everything we do is big. When you're concentrated and if your batting average is high, you can do very well, although it's a lumpier ride to success than a smooth ride to success.
To that point of you portraying yourself as something of a white knight, I wonder why you take these moral crusades to Wall Street, which fundamentally doesn't care about moral crusades.
You're correct about that. Wall Street certainly doesn't care. And the goal, our theory is this business is hard enough. You want the tailwind of doing what is in the best interest of the country, what is in the best interest of the company on a long-term basis, because without that, life's much more difficult. And the vast majority of companies in the U.S. today are really controlled by what I would describe as permanent owners of stock. Think index funds like BlackRock. Mm-hmm. So they truly do care about the business over the next 10, 20, 50 years. So the only kind of changes and campaigns we're going to run are ones that benefit the business over decades. And those are the only kind of campaigns you can win. If you have some kind of short-term strategy to make money that's harmful to the company long-term, you're not going to get the support of the BlackRocks, the Vanguards, and the others. And if you're going to short a stock on the other side of it, why not take on a company that's causing enormous economic harm and misleading people and violating the law? I mean, those are the best, you would think those would be the best companies in which to short. So it's not so much a morality play is that we want to be on the right side of what is morally right. And we can do so by being fiduciaries for our investors, because that fact has historically, in my experience, been very, very helpful to us in being successful.
I called you an activist investor. You said that was an honor. I need you to explain to the mechanic in Sheboygan or the software engineer out in Silicon Valley someplace or some guy just trying to get by in this economy, what your value add is to the American economy.
The value add of an activist, and a good one, is that we can help, prevent the next Kodak from disappearing, where, tens of thousands of jobs are lost, by waking up a complacent company to the competitive threats it faces and the inefficiency that has crept into their business because of complacency. And, activism in the public shareholder realm is not dissimilar to political activism, where someone with a relatively small number of votes gathers the votes of other constituents to put forth a plan to address some kind of problem or inequity. And this is what we are doing in the public stock market realm. Now, we're doing it with a financial goal, because the only way we were able to raise the capital from our investors to pursue the strategies is that we can't guarantee them returns. This is a strategy that can be very, very rewarding for investors. So I like investments where our interests are aligned with the country and where our economic interest allows for, if we can make ADP a more successful and more efficient company, the stock price is going to go up.
Bill Ackman is the CEO of Pershing Square Capital Management. The vote on ADP, by the way, that meeting is the 7th of November. We'll let you know how it goes. Bill, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, which is going to give you some idea of what kinds of candy I'm going to be stealing from my kids tonight. 538 did a fun little thing. The ultimate Halloween candy power ranking. In randomly generated matchups, how often a fun-sized candy, that is the little ones basically made for Halloween, how often they won against the rest of the field, any given candy, right? The actual winner and always, in my heart anyway, champion, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. Reese's Miniatures were number two, then Twix, Kit Kat, and Snickers in the 3 through 5 slots. Skittles were, as is completely appropriate, dead last. All right, we got to go. The Dow up 28 today, about a 0.1%. The NASDAQ up 28 as well, 0.4%. S&P 500 gained 2, almost a 0.1%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. The Uncertain Hour Season 2, by the way, check it out. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.